Matt Segundo here. Now, when considering the troubling question of form versus content, I find myself drawn to the former. In addition to sounding better, well, it causes me to close my eyes. I think of the word form and begin to have dangerous fantasies involving positions named after numerals. I blame Chip Kidd for all this, for steering me astray down this licentious path. My afternoons now require a great deal of Kleenex because I've now started separating these ontological elements in my daily life. And I still have to pay alimony to Doris.
Okay, so I'm here with Chip Kidd, who is most recently the author of The Learners, and who I also understand does some very interesting things involving book covers, or possibly silly things at times. Chip, how are you doing?
I'm all right.
First off, one of the interesting discoveries I made when reading The Learners was learning that the protagonist of The Cheese Monkeys actually had a name. All of a sudden, he has been named Happy, and I'm wondering what brought about this naming. Is it a matter of him kind of going out into the world? Is it a kind of Death of a Salesman homage, or what's the deal with that?
Well, I will sort of embarrassingly ask, did you read The Cheese Monkeys?
I did read The Cheese Monkeys.
He is named, I'm sorry. He gets the nickname because he's in the first crit, and he has to sort of, he's like trying to pull a rabbit out
of a hat,
and Winter says to him, gee, you're just a happy guy, aren't you?
Yes.
And so then Winter starts calling him Happy, and Himilzi does a little bit just to rib him. So it's not, once that happens, you don't hear it a lot more.
Yeah.
Whereas in
in this,
in
he's
the learners,
just addressed
you do,
Happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, I mean, in terms of the name Happy, was it Death of a Salesman scenario or that? Or in terms of naming him, would Death of a Salesman crop up to mind? I should also point out that there was actually as well an homage to White Noise in both books, where you have a laundry list of that has involved station wagons that is very reminiscent of the opening page of White Noise.
So
I'm wondering if you've struck up some sort of clandestine agreement with Don DeLillo or something for this.
You are clearly a lot smarter than I am. I think I'd kind of just like walk backwards into all of these things. If it's there, it's pretty subconscious. For me, the name Happy, it's sort of like a blatantly obvious, embarrassingly so. It's like when, you know, you have one of those World War II pictures and you have, the band of the soldiers that are good friends. And one of them's this huge moose-like guy and he's named Tiny. And then you've got somebody who's bald, who's named Curly. So you've got this guy who's named Happy,
yes.
You know, and that just kind of infers that he's probably potentially the opposite. But in terms of fiction, the fictitious Happy that rings the most for me is Matt Murdock's assistant in Daredevil.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
It's the Happy I know.
Well, the name Himilzi, and in fact Himilzi crops up in this book, but it's interesting to me because she appears only to, without giving anything away, disappear rather rapidly.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if this was kind of, well, we can't bring back the supporting characters quite specifically because we're kind of building a new narrative on top of that, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, in the first draft, first of all, I guess I should say that I had a really, really good editor on this book, a guy named Colin Harrison, who was a different editor than I had on Cheese Monkeys, the equally wonderful Sarah McGrath, who then left before my first draft was done. And this, you know, while it sort of freaked me out at first, it turned out to be very good because Colin hadn't read the Cheese Monkeys,
mm-hmm.
and purposefully did not, so that he could give the first draft a real fresh read and make sure that this book will work if you haven't read The Cheese Monkeys, because it needs to.
Yeah.
It needs to stand on its own. It is sort of episode two, but I mean, it's technically a sequel, but it has to read like it's not a sequel.
The thing about Himilzi that was interesting is that she also seems to sort of see into the future. You have a reality TV show that she's kind of envisioning. And there's also an aspect of her kind of cribbing Albert Brooks's Defending Your Life when she's mentioning that people only use 10% of their brain.
Oh, right.
So I was wondering if you envisioned her as some sort of cultural soothsayer.
Yeah, sort of. One of the epigrams of the book is an idea ahead of its time is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, you know, so, and it's very easy to set a book 40 years in the past and then have people making all these predictions about things that actually come true. You know, it's like, duh. I mean, that's pretty easy. But I guess I am. I do try to set her up. She has a lot of interesting ideas, and she's frankly never really going to do anything with any of them. It's just she's one of the, and you know, that based on a lot of people I knew at art school who had great ideas and but just did not have the wherewithal to follow through with them.
Sort of the Philo Farnsworths, essentially, of that particular this particular book, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about Tip. Who
yes.
often makes a lexical blending of sorts by inventing terms like antisappointment and things
right.
like that. I was wondering if this was your particular war on sort of undue coinage in some instances, because he does have a lot of words that just aren't going to quite catch on, but he does cling to them quite strenuously. You know?
Yeah, well, he's a word guy, and he's a copywriter for an ad agency, and he's went to Yale, and he's very smart, and his parents were psychiatrists, so, you know, and he, Tip, and this is no great secret, I do this whole weird name game in this book, in that the name of the firm is Speer, Rakoff, and Ware. Which is based on three of my best friends, Jeff Speer, David Rakoff, and Chris Ware. But there are characters based on them in the book, but they are not named that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of needlessly confusing. The Chris Ware character is actually Sketchy Speer, not Preston Ware.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, my point being, Tip Skickney is based on my friend, the writer David Rakoff.
Yeah.
And so he embodies a lot of his, you know, his wit, and David's parents are psychiatrists,
yeah.
and David has this sort of wonderfully, morose way of looking at everything that's also kind of deliciously funny. So that's where that comes from, and David's very much a very smart word guy. When I'm writing stuff, I'm pulling things out of my life all the time, and this completely other friend of mine who's a film director told me about the antisappointment.
Mm-hmm.
Used it in a sentence, you know. Oh, he also told me about frenemy, which I think is much more common now. So I didn't use that, but I liked antisappointment.
But it could also go by the wayside, like dramedy. Who uses that anymore? You know? But I mean, in terms of dwelling upon names of your friends, is there a kind of danger in doing that? I mean, in terms of drawing too much from personal experience for a specific...
In terms of upsetting them, you mean?
Well, not only upsetting them, but I mean, I'm wondering how you keep things creative or how you sort of tweak things from the real if you're basing them very explicitly on personal.
I think for me, it's a sort of sentimental crutch. I'm a very sentimental person, and I liked it would be one thing if I made Tip into an asshole.
Yeah.
Basically. Can I?
Oh, you can say whatever you want.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
That would not be a good thing, you know, for David. That would be like, that's not my intention. Like, there's characters in the book that maybe aren't, at first you think you're not supposed to like them, but I'm hoping that there'll be something that comes along that maybe you do a little bit. I don't like have it in for anybody. So I didn't see a real danger. I just, for me, it makes it interesting that the Chris Ware character is really only has certain aspects of the real person. Physically, he's not anything like him. He's a good deal older. And Sketchy Speer is basically, what if Chris Ware had his talent and didn't have the courage to become a cartoonist with it? What if he, you know, what if it was a much more conservative time and he felt that, you know, I could be a cartoonist, but I need to apply this to a trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so he becomes this, he channels all this cartooning into the ads that he's drawing and putting, frankly, far too much work into them. Mm-hmm. So it's Chris, but it's not Chris. And of course, you know, David Rakoff is not an ad copywriter either. So it's that kind of like, what if just using these parts of people I know in order to inform these characters that are really only partially based on them and who took people who took different paths with their lives than maybe they should have.
There's lengthy digressions in this, generally confined to a page, that deal with the relationship of form versus content.
Mm-hmm.
But it also strikes me that it's not necessarily form versus content as it is the medium. For example, you often capitalize words that are being emphasized in dialogue. And if you did that, for example, online, you would be accused of shouting, whereas in this, it has a completely different sort of feel because it's rendered in print.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to sort of ask you about this. Is the form versus content, these dialogues, which are, you know, definitely comic in nature,
mm-hmm.
is this also sort of a way for you to kind of draw attention to the fact that, well, this dialectic is actually happening within the book and that therefore there's some sort of larger kind of dialogue if you were to view this in relation to, say, other mediums?
I started off with the whole form and content, you know, dichotomy. But then what I'm really trying to talk about, you know, because in the Cheese Monkeys, there were these digressions on very, very basic issues of form, big versus small, going from left to right and top to bottom, you know, very, very basic graphic design stuff. And then at the end... the narrator, well, not the narrator, it's the teacher, says, oh, but look at the time, we have to go. We've only been talking about form. Next time we're going to talk about content. So these are diversions are really mostly supposed to be about content, but also how content can be divided into two different things, as in what I'm actually telling you and what I mean, what I mean. And if I am telling you what I mean, that's sincerity. So we do a whole... digression on sincerity, and that's the final one, actually. If I'm telling you something that isn't true, that's deception. I'm going to do a digression on deception, and irony and metaphor and wit, and I forget what the other ones are, and or maybe that's it. But it's really about messages and decoding messages, encoding messages, again, very basic stuff, but getting a couple levels deeper than just what something looks like. It's now we're talking about language. Now we're talking about, you know, what somebody's telling you and what, how to perceive that. And, you know, these aren't wildly new ideas at all to consider, but they are applicable. They're applicable to the story, they're applicable to advertising, they're applicable to the Stanley Milgram experiments, and just the whole basic media age that we've become, whether it's advertising or the internet or a combination of the two.
But there's also something interesting in juxtaposing this discussion amidst an obedience experiment of Stanley Milgram's, because you as author are essentially dictating or declaring your particular personal vision in this particular book. So this leads me to sort of believe that how much the reader chooses to obey by dwelling upon specific stylistic tics is as much a part of the reading process as actually enjoying the story. And I wanted to ask you about this, if this was something that you had in mind.
God, you are so much smarter than I am. You really are. You've like thought about this in a much more careful way than I have. I'm not quite sure what the question is. I think I want the reader to encounter these experiments, at least at first, as anybody else would have back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you do, you start to think about it. And then I give the narrator, and thus the reader, this opportunity to go back now and observe them the way Milgram observed them, in order to fully comprehend what he was doing and what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator thinks that this is going to help him. And in some ways it does, but in the ways that he really needs it, it doesn't. In strange ways, it makes things worse for him.
But I guess my question, just to clarify, is to what extent is the reader intended to obey the book's stylistic dicta that it lays down? You know what I mean?
Totally.
Yeah.
Completely.
Completely.
Yeah.
So the reader is enslaved. The reader is enslaved to you then, basically. He's obeying.
Well, I think, you know, if you're doing your job as a writer, the reader will be enslaved to you. I mean, I don't think I'm trying to make them do anything immoral. You know, I'm not Ann Coulter. But yeah, you know, if somebody reads the book and they're captivated by it, that's fine. Yeah. That I think that's good.
I was struck by the rather disturbing sentence, "The experiment requires you to continue," during the Milgram mm-hmm. Moment, the during section mm-hmm. of the book. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if this particular sentence just struck out at you as the sort of the sentence to really demonstrate the horror of having to, you know, press the buttons and the like. And also, how much of that was taken from your very thorough research into Milgram?
Oh, directly.
Directly.
Yeah. I mean, I frankly bring, as a writer or a creative person, very, very little to that section in terms, you know, in terms of dialogue. And there's a digression where he has this memory of listening to Tarzan on the radio, and all, obviously all that is me bringing something to it. But in terms of the mechanics, and I really tried to be, in the author's note at the end, to make this very clear, in terms of what they're saying and what they're doing, it is all word for word from what they actually said and what they actually did. Mm-hmm. And it's not, it's all very, very well documented. Milgram finally officially published his findings in 74 in Obedience to Authority, which I have in there. And he made this film, which is what I first saw as a freshman in psychology.
Yeah.
And I was able to buy a copy of it. It's not easy to do, but you can, you know, if you do a little detective work on the web, you can buy it under the auspices of showing it in a class.
Yeah.
You know, it's a commercially available class film.
Gotcha. But then at the same time, one of the more Baroque stylistics in the book comes during that during section where you have the bold text ensnared in these kind of gradients of gray of italics over that.
Did that work for you?
I thought
honest.
I thought it did, actually. I actually really liked that moment because it was sort of an eye-jolting sort of moment for me. And I'm wondering if you felt that you needed to kind of have this sort of disorientation, because it also reminded me very much of like those old the 3D art that used to be in like the 90s. You know, remember that? You know, I'm not sure if that's what you were going for with that, but
no. Again, but that particular thing that you cite, I was very on the fence about it, and I had the list of people that I thank in the acknowledgments. Most of those people were my hierarchy of readers. Mm-hmm. So once I had the first draft done, that went to my editor, and then I would prevail upon my friends, most of whom are writers, to then, okay, you read the second draft, make notes. So that section, people either were like, not sure this works, or wow, that's great. Mm-hmm. And the wow, that's great one, but graphically, it bothers me because it's so isolated. Like, it, in theory, what would be best is if things are going along and then you turn the page and you get like a double spread of it or something like that. And I just couldn't figure out how to do that. It would just be too much. And I think it would just be too affected.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I mean, I think because you're caught up so much in the dialogue that's taken from the Milgram experiment that you really don't focus in on that, or at least I didn't mm-hmm. when I read it. I was just kind of like, ooh, this is very interesting, mm-hmm. this dialogue. And so I'm wondering, though, why you felt the need to have this flourish there to kind of jolt the reader. Is it, again, a sort of form versus content? And it's also interesting that you have bold occluded by the gray as well. Normally it's the other way around, or mm-hmm. you know, and all that. I'm wondering.
It's really just a pictogram visual depiction of because at that point in the experiment, the screaming is just nonstop, and it's, you know, it's loud and blood curdling and et cetera, and it just fills the background. And then at that particular level, whatever it was, I think 375 volts or whatever it is, once that button was pushed, then it stopped. Yeah. It instantly stopped. And that's really all it is. It's just trying to get that point across.
I also wanted to ask you about the concern for precision in your details. Mm-hmm. For example, you have a guy cracking his fingers, and it's described as the sound of 10 popsicle sticks snapping in half, which mm-hmm. is very precise. Not like 9 or 8. It could have been 9 or 8, actually. But one of the things I really liked was the lady with ice white hair, the shape and texture of spun sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering about this kind of almost over the top precision that is often there in this book. Where does this come about? Do you feel the need to just really, this is the only way to convey, or does this come from your graphical background, dealing with visuals and wanting to have...
He's a young graphic designer just out of school,
yeah.
So he's just eating it all up with his eyes. It's like graphic designers who are really into it and love it and are constantly observing things, and the only difference is Happy is observing things and then articulating it to you. You know, whereas graphic designers may or may not do that. I mean, they're going to observe it, but whether then they describe it a certain way is, you know, who knows. But it's that sense that he is just visually this voracious person who's trying to, you know, he looking at the shock machine at Milgram and saying, you know, well, that's Helvetica 12-point, you know, kerned to, you know, the third degree, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but I also think that this is a bit of a disingenuous answer on your part because it does come from you, and certainly the same kind of brio that you throw into this book is very much evident in your YouTube video that's now currently making the rounds in promotion of this book.
Uh-huh.
Some people on the YouTube comments are saying, boy, this guy's really frightening. So, I mean, you know, there is some legitimacy to my sort of answer, so I have to ask you again about this nature of kind of going over the top in prose or this kind of thing. Does this give you a sort of additional push? Does it help you to permit your voice to just, for you to know that your voice is actually on the page by having, you know, sugar?
I mean, absolutely. He is me, basically. I mean, he's like a form of me. You know, I'm not trying to write in the voice of a, you know, 45-year-old housewife from Bethesda, Maryland. You know, I have total respect for people who can do that. But I'm not particularly good at it. So yeah, I mean, it's just part of my nature. It's part of my personality. You know, sometimes I'm a subtle person and other times I'm just like off the wall goofy. I don't know.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about the page margins, which are considerable in both books, and why you feel the need to have a book out there that just really has generous page margins like this. Are you encouraging readers to sort of annotate it on the side, or what's the deal?
No, it's really just about a very nice proportion for your eye. It's one of my, as a reader first and a graphic designer, book designer second, these books that are set, and I'm not, you know, this isn't a recent phenomenon, but, you know, like when the line is too long and the letting is not enough, it's just a chore. Mm-hmm. It's a chore. Now, from a practical point of view, it makes a relatively short book seem longer because it takes up more pages. But really, it's just a typographical, what's easiest on the eye. It's almost like the pages are more tidbit-like, and they're more literally digestible in this form. That's how I see it.
I'm wondering if you tried to proselytize this particular viewpoint onto others, because most books don't have those kinds of margins. Have you had any success in convincing people that generous margins is really the way to go? Is this something that is part of your platform, so to speak?
I would be happy to, you know, if somebody asked me, I do some interior design. I guess there's no point in it's a verbal interview, but like for the Donna Tartt books, yeah. For example, I design, and I do try to keep the line as generously short as possible. But you know, if somehow somebody looks at this and says, "Gee, I think we should design a shorter line length, that's fine with me.
But McSweeney's also does a lot of this, too, of a lot of their books as well, and also a lot of their editions. So I'm wondering, I'm just curious as to, you know, whether there is an actual legitimate movement going on here or whether it might just be a current sort of trend that you're trying to keep in enter into the mainstream or something like that.
I hope that things are moving that way. The McSweeney's books are fantastic. They're beautiful, beautifully designed. It's probably one of the single best designed imprints overall operating today. I know for a fact that with certain books, the publisher will have, it'll be in the publisher will think it's in their best interest to keep the page count as unscary as possible. So I'm looking for an example. But, you know, like if you have an author that really brings in like a brick-like manuscript of a zillion pages, depending on the subject matter, the publisher is going to want to... There's all sorts of tricks you can do to control the page count or to control the thickness. Like, ooh, we're going to make the paper thinner. Personally, I don't really see a problem with that as a designer. Like, if you know, if it's 1,000 pages and it's 1,000 pages worth reading, then so what, you know?
But I'm wondering if this is a consideration too, because if you're dealing with a book that may have a more bit of a sort of, you know, boost to it in the design, mm-hmm. that's going to possibly add some more money in terms of actually producing each particular unit. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how you sort of negotiate that territory between, you know, something that looks good, that is a hardcover that you would be willing to just, you know, look through, just mm-hmm. look through, mm-hmm. versus something that's kind of, you know, I mean, I've seen increasingly more hardcover books that just really, I'm like, well, this may as well have been issued in paperback because the paper's just junk. It's printed haphazardly, slapdashly, and all that. So, I mean, you know, do you think that that this attention is dying? Do you sometimes possibly take on so many projects often where you can't always get that attention to detail for every particular book?
Well, I, you know, budgets are just shrink and shrink and shrink for paper, for, you know, binding. And again, that's what's so inspirational about the McSweeney stuff is that, you know, they'll go to Iceland and get it printed there so they can get full cloth and they can do this and do that. And we do, I mean, we have our production guys, the best, Andy Hughes, and he figured out how to produce Jimmy Corrigan, the smartest kid on earth, for $26.95 in hardcover, which was quite astonishing. Yeah. And we basically go the opposite of Iceland. We go to mostly to the Far East and to China. But we can't do that with all of our books because the we do it with a lot of the graphic novels and the visual stuff. But with the other you know, prose novels, we don't do it because the shipping time that you have to build in is quite considerable.
But there's also a case to possibly be made about seeing, say, a Word file versus seeing it printed in some kind of in the font, the kerning, everything. Some books and some text are dramatically obviously improved mm-hmm. by such a treatment. So, I mean, it's almost like you're playing sort of Sophie's Choice here between which book gets the better treatment and which one does not. Do you have any input on that end as to, like, you know, well, look, this book would really be helped if you laid it out this way, and it would really cause people to go crazy about it?
It all depends on the project. Certainly with any of my books, yeah, I have total control. Less so, extremely less so, for a lot of books that I'm just doing the jackets for, because that's mainly what I'm being hired to do. And I mean, frankly, and this is going to sound like I'm the laziest person on the planet, interior book design is for the most part a thankless task that requires a ton of attention, a ton of time, and it's attention and time that I just don't have to spare for a lot of it. So I, you know, I've done it here for Haruki Murakami, for Donna Tartt, and if I don't do an interior for a book I'm doing the cover for, it doesn't mean I don't care about it. It just, you know, we also have an entire other department of people who just do that here. Mm-hmm. And I have to be very sort of, I have to let them do their job.
Yeah, Yeah, obviously. Well, I also wanted to ask you, while we're on this subject, in The Learners, there's a schismatic look to it, both in the dust jacket, which is cut.
Mm-hmm.
I feel sort of kind of sad because I have it here in my bag and it's kind of denuded of its cover, or of its jacket, I feel like I've corrupted it in some sense. But also in the way that you've kind of, you've taken the copyright page and cut it in half and the mm-hmm. like. And I'm wondering if it was just the sort of schismatic nature of Happy that spawned this particular decision, or just a desire to kind of shake things up a little bit and have you flip it over. It's almost like a Mad Folden, you know?
I think it's more the latter than the former. In terms of little design tricks, I sort of went nuts with the cheese monkeys and, oh, let's print the acknowledgments along the edge of the binding and all of that. It was fun, and I certainly don't regret it, and people really reacted to it favorably, I think. It was, you know, the joke was, here's this book designer that's doing all this stuff that you're not supposed to do. So I did that, and with the new one, there really isn't as much in terms of trickery going on. You know, I fiddled with it. I mean, the thing about the copyright information is, you know, why not mess with it? But, you know, then the lawyers get all freaked out because that literally is what that's for. It's like to, you know, stake all our claims to everything so that everything legally is in place. But the truth is, as long as all of the information is represented, you can do whatever you want with it. You know, so that's all that's about. It's like, oh, let's run it through, entering one page, coming out the other. And then really, that's about it. There really was. Oh, and then the title page, basically, all of the information is sort of like, again, that was the one thing that you're not supposed to do that I didn't do in The Cheese Monkeys, which is have it basically all disappears into the gutter, you know, in this kind of like, oh, you know, it just looks like a. I mean, hopefully it looks like a total mistake, but if you know enough about who I am and what I do, you'll realize it's really just having fun with the title page.
You know, I think the lawyers would probably be interested in this because it would probably encourage people to read the copyright page because it's now on two pages as opposed to one, essentially.
I don't know.
Well, there's also the advertisement with the explanation of all the fonts mm-hmm. and all that. Mm-hmm. And yes, the trickery and the explanation and the pushing things to the side are definitely muted. But there's this helpful kind of diagram that kind of explains the motivating impetus behind this ad that, you know, the character inevitably responds to.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you why this felt necessary, because aside from this and really the sort of the form versus content dialogue, it's pretty much almost all prose for the most part.
Yeah, it's again, that's all the genuine information in the ad is there. Like, all of that is real. And it really is literally, okay, let's design it. I basically redesigned it. Now, I couldn't, because of the context of everything, I couldn't show the actual Milgram ad and then show my redesign of it, because that's a whole other book. I mean, that wouldn't fall into place. It would make any sense with the narrative. So it's basically more about, okay, this is all the information he gave me, and this is how you organize it. And again, it's like type 101. And dealing with typography, especially in this microcosmic little space, it's really tough, and it's a pain in the neck. And it was certainly a lot tougher in 1961 than it is now, because you know, you had to photo order that and spec it, and if you spec'd it wrong, you'd have to cut it all up and repaste it or reorder it again, which costs more money. And so it's sort of practical and totally impractical at the same time. It's sort of showing you what he's knows about this and really what's entailed. I mean, in some ways, it's just sort of dry and boring, but at the same time, it is sincere. It's a total sincere sort of like, this is what this typeface is called, and this is why I spec this way, so that this is the first thing you see, and then hopefully this is the second thing you see, and that you will fill this out and mail it in and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So
Well, I also wanted to remark upon the colors that are throughout the text that you describe. I mean, mm-hmm. that you describe as opposed to actually it being a sort of colorful situation. Mm-hmm. But you have, for example, you have Tip asking the question, what does green sound like?
Mm-hmm.
You have at one point, you know, in the Milgram experiment, when he enters the equation, Milgram himself, to Happy's first response is, can you hear me? Or rather, he responds to, can you hear me? And he says, black, grays, white. And there's also a concern for fluorescent, which presumably is kind of influenced by the shifty lighting going above or whatnot. But I wanted to sort of ask you this notion of colors that are being deliberately subverted from the primary sense of visual. How did this come about? Is this a kind of way to offer the clue to the reader that really sort of mixing things up and mashing perceptions and sort of taking one sense and applying it to another is part of the problem that Happy and these various characters are kind of suffering from in this?
Yes, although again it's about the way he perceives things. What is it like to wait to faint and then wake up? It's black first and then it's grayer and then it's white and then it's fluorescent when you open your eyes. Again, it's part of his sensibility of how he views the world. And you know, in their advertisements, they're going to be dealing with color. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, obviously, because they're doing a lot of newspaper stuff. But, you know, Tip is constantly exploring and wants to expand his thought process. And until Happy comes along, there's no one for him to play with, really, in this sense. So for him to say, what does green sound like, is for him, it's a perfectly natural question. And for me, it's not. And then I have to sort of figure out how to answer it. And he's also very obsessed with free association in order to try and generate ad copy or mood or whatever.
Well, there's also this sense, too. I mean, since we're on the subject, you know, how we were describing earlier how the cheese monkeys doesn't have nearly as much playing around with layout and the like. And so I'm wondering if writing in this, just sticking precisely with the prose as opposed to the design, represented more of a challenge for you for this book, because now you have to convey information and senses and viscera this way. I mean, you were doing this before, but but now you're doing it to a more kind of, I guess, almost orthodox kind of way with this. So did this present any particular sort of challenges along these lines?
Not really. I mean, I'm drawing more visual elements into the prose itself with, you know, very simple. If you're trying to say something, the typeface you use is going to change its meaning. Very simple idea. And so you have to visually show that in the text. But it's really getting into other areas of graphic design that the cheese monkeys didn't. I wasn't about to show any of the assignment, any of the stuff that they did in the class. You know, you have to build all that in your head. So now you don't have to build the typefaces in your head, but certainly there's plenty that you need to sort of construct basically what I'm giving you.
Well, there's a number of typefaces throughout this book as well, and I'm wondering if you had to kind of restrain yourself at times to sort of, I guess, stick with one particular typeface. I mean, there's no sort of like switching of typeface midway through the book like there was with Cheese. But I mean, I mean, still, there's this concern for multiple typefaces, and I'm wondering how much you had to rein that impulse in during the writing of this.
Reining it in was a good thing, I think. I thought about that. I thought, you know, that switch of the prose font in Cheese Monkeys is really crucial, and a lot of people got it, which was great. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't think, like I did think about, because it's in three parts, and he takes the experiment in the second part. And then I thought about, okay, now in the third part, he's literally a changed person. So maybe his dialogue should all be in sans serif now. you know, that kind of stuff, to just to emphasize how dead he was inside, or dead inside he was becoming. And it is about reining it in, you know, that I think you've got to have the right balance so that it doesn't look like you're just going gimmick happy, so to speak. And I just, that was one idea that I kind of ruled out, that no, you know, it's just underlining it too much.
But you do have the indents in the book kind of shift. There's like a different indent for spacing in terms of the paragraph, in terms of the description. And I didn't think it was just a typographic issue. I thought it was deliberate on your part. It's extremely small, but noticeable if you're paying attention, and I wanted to ask you about that.
It's probably more like a technical problem in Quark than anything else.
Okay.
Because I don't hit the tab button. I hit 5 space buttons in order to go in, and it's a habit. I don't want to break it, actually. I don't particularly know why, but you do get these varying indents, which I think are kind of nice. I mean,
at first I was tempted to derive great import from this, and then I realized that it could have just been a sort of accidental impulse, or just to kind of look to have this kind of jaggedy sort of
thing. It is accidental, but I like it. And, you know, again, I hope it doesn't look like I think I'm getting away with something or trying to, I don't know, mislead the reader in a bad way, that it means something. It's more about just the way the words and sentences fall in this program on the page.
Yeah. I'm wondering, in terms of meaning something, how much can one read the learners as meaning something, in the sense of, well, there are these form and content page-length digressions, mm-hmm. and there's also this story, and there's also this kind of being thrown into Milgram. So one, you know, one is, again, tempted to sort of, like, look into certain aspects of this. Like, for example, you were talking about how he changes in the after section, and I had noticed that after the Milgram section, his prose or his descriptions are less wild and gleeful. They become more using more routine phrases, and I wanted to sort of ask you about little things like that.
His tone changes.
Yeah.
Less, you know, he goes into the experiment, and it's kind of like a goof for him. And, oh, this fat Wally and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And there's a lot of that in the first section, too. But, yeah, his tone definitely gets more sober.
Yeah.
More sober. He's got his moments of still, you know, making fun of things a little bit and wit and that. But, yeah, he's a different person. You know, it's like when you... If you've ever gone through a phase like that where you're depressed or whatever, you know, you don't...
But
your tone changes.
It's interesting because I don't know really if it's quite the trauma from having undergone the experiment or the trauma because of one of the characters.
There's an accumulation of things. One of the characters, something bad happens to. And he also feels... that there's something that he could have and should have done to stop that, and he didn't. So there's that. There's the experiment. There's this whole subplot about the potato chip account, and in a strange move, Happy sort of saves and ruins the crinkle cut account, you know. And so he has a tremendous amount of guilt about that, and so there is an accumulation of stuff. It's not just the experiment, it's this, you know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of crinkle cut, well, my mind sort of thinks of Pringles, and I was wondering if there's some sort of legal issue there.
No, but rather late in the game, I was like, I said to myself, idiot, you need to Google crinkle cut chips and make sure they don't frickin' exist.
Yeah.
And sure enough, like in Australia or something like that. So I changed the spelling. That's why it's crinkle cut with 2 T's and 2 K's.
Well, Chip, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.